The peaceful countries of Scandinavia are producing quantities of murder and mayhem these days in the form of best-selling mystery novels. Perhaps it's those long, dark winters. Leading the invasion of Nordic noir is Sweden's Henning Mankell. He's well known as the creator of the gruff and rumple detective Kurt Wallander, now the subject of a PBS series. And while Mankell's latest book, The Man from Beijing, has a different hero, readers will still be hooked by the saga and the opening scene. A photographer is traveling through rural Sweden in winter. He arrives in a village he plans to photograph, but something about the cluster of small houses seems wrong.
The chimneys, they were cold. There was no sign of smoke. His gaze moved slowly from house to house. Somebody's cleared the snow already, he thought. But not lit a single fire.
That's Henning Mankell reading from the beginning of The Man from Beijing.
He remembered a letter he'd received from the man who had told him about the village. He had referred to the chimneys and how the houses seemed, in a childish sort of way, to be sending smoke signals to one another. But now, not a sign of smoke.
And from there it gets really scary. Because when the photographer goes to try to find somebody in the village, knocks on doors, nobody answers, finally he looks in a window, and almost everyone in the whole village is dead.
Yes, that's the starting point of this story, yes.
Has anything like that ever happened in Sweden, a mass murder of that kind?
As far as I know, never. But I do write fiction, and the definition of fiction is very simple. It is that what I write is something that could have happened, but not necessarily has happened.
Many of your books have been thrillers of one kind or another, or police procedurals. This book represents a change in that your detective, Kurt Wallander, is not in it, and you've switched to a cast of characters that are almost all women. Not only the protagonist who solves the problem, but other characters as well. There are a whole lot of women in this book.
Yes. I grew up, my father was a judge. This time when I wrote The Man from Beijing, I decided to use my knowledge about, well, the knowledge of a judge. But to distance myself from my father, I chose to make a female judge.
Is it different to write about women?
Well, I'm always very interested in reading what women write about men. So I guess that women are as interested to see what men are writing about women. Since we are living in a world where women are almost always better than men on doing everything, then I think it's very important to find out why is it so? Why do women do things better than men? I really mean now what I'm saying, because women doesn't start war, for example. And so I'm always very interested to see the perspective of women, how they look upon the world.
The story is a complicated story, and it's what you switch scenes there from Sweden to briefly in the United States. Africa plays a role, but mostly China. Where does that come from?
As you know, I live part-time of my life in Africa since almost 30 years. I live in Mozambique, and about 10 years ago, the Chinese government had offered the government of Mozambique to build a new building for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Fine, that's good. And so the Chinese started to build this building. But then suddenly there were rumors that the Chinese foremen did treat the African workers badly. And there were even rumors that the Chinese foremen started to beat the African workers. And at that time I asked myself, hey, what is happening here? And at that time, I decided I would like to write about this.
Part of your plot in writing about the Chinese coming to Africa is you are writing about the idea of dominion, of domination, China absorbing Africa's natural resources and taking them away. Do you actually see any of that kind of thing happening? I mean, you're living in Africa, you have a view of it that we don't have.
Yeah, I see a good presence of the Chinese. I see how they offer to, willingly to help with building infrastructures. But the other side of the coin is some tendencies of a sort of colonial idea. And one of the worst cases, and this is really happening, And this goes not only for China, it's also other countries in Asia that is now buying up agricultural land in Africa, where there's supposed to be produced food that is being brought back to China while the hungry Africans are standing outside. So I would say that I'm building my novel on facts and on real worries. I really think it's very good that China takes an important role and position in the world. But we have to have a critical view upon that, as we have to have for the Russians and even for the Americans, in a way.
So what do you think is coming next? Are you still thinking in these terms of China and Africa, or the judicial system? Or are you going back to Wallander?
No, actually, I think that I am going in another direction now. As you know, it's very difficult. You shouldn't talk about what you are writing for the time being. But next novel, it's going to be something very, very, very different.
No hint?
The leading lady will once again be a lady, and it's going to be a Swedish woman that goes 100 years ago. This is built upon a real story that goes to Africa and all of a sudden finds herself as an owner of a brothel. But more than that, I cannot say.
Okay.
It's a good start of a story, don't you think?
I would say it's a very good start of a story. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Henning Mankell is the author of The Man from Beijing. He also writes the popular Kurt Wallander series. And he says, be on the lookout for another Wallander book. It is called The Troubled Man. It arrives in the States in 2011. And if you want more of the chilling beginning of The Man from Beijing, read it at our website, npr.org.
When he was a kid in the early 1970s, British writer Philip Hoare went to see Ramu the whale perform at the Windsor Safari Park, just outside London. Ramu was an orca captured a few years earlier, and by then trained to entertain.
The whale went through his routine, responding to his trainer's demands like a lapdog, when he leapt in the air and landed with a splash, soaking the thrilled ringside audience at this orca circus. It was as if he'd been beaten back by his captivity, even as his proud dorsal fin flopped impotently over his back.
Though captive whales would later disturb Philip Hoare, that first encounter sparked a lifelong obsession with these mammals and with the book Moby Dick. And for 5 years, Hoare traveled from New Bedford in Massachusetts to Nantucket, on to Liverpool and beyond, to trace the path taken by that book's narrator, Ishmael. The result is The Whale. It's a book that's part travelogue, part literary critique, and part meditation on these extraordinary and once exploited creatures.
When I was a boy, I ate whale oil margarine. My mother wore makeup made with whale oil. You know, people played tennis with rackets strung with whale guts, you know, wore shoes tanned with whale oil as well. So up until the 60s, certainly in Britain, whales were used as a resource.
How did you decide to use the story of Moby Dick as a kind of a device to tell the story of whales?
Well, like many people, I tried to read Moby Dick and didn't get very far. I had to take two or three runs at it before I actually got through it. And really, I suppose, like Melville, I felt, you know, I just became so obsessed with the notion of the whale and it's the fact that it represents this huge paradox. It's the world's greatest animal, the hugest animal, and yet we hardly ever see it. And when we do, we just see this kind of jigsaw component, a fluke or a dorsal fin or a pectoral fin. We can never put this jigsaw puzzle together, and that's what I was trying to do.
Philip Hoare, you start the narrative in this book in New Bedford, Massachusetts, which at one time was the center or a center of global whaling.
Well, I mean, New Bedford, I think, is an amazing place. I mean, it was the richest city in America during the height of the whaling boom. You must remember that before the invention, or rather the discovery of petroleum in Pennsylvania in 1859, the Industrial Revolution was lit and lubricated by the oil of whales. Mm. So, you know, that's where street lighting came from. That's where candles, you know, came from. That's where, you know, machines were lubricated from. So it had a tremendous importance in the early industrial world. And that's why also whaling became important for America, because it was the first sort of global economic reach of the new republic.
I was struck by some of the facts in the book, that the heart of a blue whale is the size of a car, for example, that the humpback whale follows the longest, the longest annual migration of any mammal. And yet you write that we actually don't know a whole lot about whales.
Oh, you know, I mean, if you were to measure whale science on a scale of 1 to 10, we're at 0.11%, you know. We just are in our infancy of our understanding of these creatures, partly because up until very recently, you know, our relationship with them was entirely as a resource. They were an industry. They fed and oiled our world. So, you know, the notion of, you know, seeing them as a natural wonder is a very recent thing in a way. I mean, it's really starting in the 1960s, the whole sort of humpback song, which was recorded by Roger Payne, the song of the humpback whale, which sort of made the album charts. And so, you know, we've moved very quickly in that way.
Man walked on the moon before we actually photographed whales living underwater.
Well, certainly sperm whales. No one had filmed a sperm whale underwater at all until long after we'd landed on the moon. You know, we know more about the surface of the moon than we know about the bottom of the sea. It's so impossible to actually study a whale like the sperm whale, which is the deepest diving whale. It dives for a mile. It can stay down for 2 hours. We don't even know how it feeds. You know, sperm whales have huge teeth, canine, 42 canine in its lowest jaw, but the females don't have those teeth, so those teeth aren't used for feeding. So even something as simple as how a sperm whale feeds, we don't know the answer.
How much do you think the way we think about, particularly about sperm whales today, comes from Melville's book?
We're kind of haunted by Moby Dick, and it's odd because one of the themes of Melville's book is that Ahab is a demented man because he's impugning evil to an animal, which cannot possibly think in those terms. And yet, you know, we live with this notion, you know, still of the whale as being a ferocious creature, of a sperm whale being a ferocious creature. I've been in the water with sperm whales. They are the most timid animals. They are freaked out by a dolphin. They are not these leviathans of yore. They are an eternal paradox. And that's why for artists, for writers, scientists, everyone, they just represent this extraordinary enigma.
As you say, you actually swam with sperm whales in the Azores. And, of course, this is the mythical whale described by Melville. What was it like to actually be in the water with these enormous mammals?
The single most extraordinary moment of my life. I was licensed by the Azorean government to do this. It's not something I would recommend. But I got in the water. I was snorkeling towards this pod of 12, mostly female sperm whales. I mean, these are big creatures, get up to 50 foot long. And as I swam to them, one of them detached from the pod and came swimming towards me, at which point I lost control of my bodily functions.
I mean, you were terrified.
I was utterly terrified, utterly terrified. It was like having a granite cliff swimming towards you. And I thought that the whale was just going to either swallow me or swim into me, because a sperm whale's vision is very limited. At that moment, I felt its echolocation moving through my skeleton, through my sternum, through my skull, creating a three-dimensional sound picture of me in its head. I physically felt that. It was the most incredible feeling. And then at the last moment, as it came as close to me as, you know, this microphone is, it turned and looked at me directly in the eye. And then it dove from this blue into the black below. I mean, the waters there are 3 miles deep, and just vanished.
It's an amazing culmination of a story that begins when you actually learn how to swim as an adult to this moment where you are in the water with these creatures.
Well, from my deep childhood fear of water, I mean, I as you say, I didn't learn to swim until I was 25. And, you know, I had recurring nightmares about sea monsters and whales and things. And so the writing of the book was a kind of confrontation of my own fears in a way, and of the general fears and apprehensions and anxieties we have about the water and about what it contains.
Over the sort of the course of researching this book, the 5 years that you spent sort of following in the footsteps of Ishmael and learning about whales, did it sort of change some of your assumptions about the book and about the animal you were studying?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think I started out with quite an objective viewpoint. In fact, one of the things I wanted to do is portray exactly why sort of young men went on these extraordinary 5-long-year voyages off to sort of hunt these whales and try and explain something from the human side point of view. But the more I was confronted with the physical reality of these creatures, the more I felt, you know, it's like that moment when I got in the water with the sperm whale, I actually felt I wanted to apologize to it, which is not to come over all sort of new agey and whatever, but it's, you know, you just realize what these creatures have suffered at the hands of man, that they have always been the losers, you know, and, you know, whatever the political or, you know, economic circumstances, it's the whale that always loses out. And, you know, and they are an ecological barometer. And I think we ignore their fate at our peril.
That's Philip Hoare. His new book is called The Whale, In Search of the Giants of the Deep. Philip Hoare, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Every so often, a novel comes along that captures the moment. Adam Hazlett's new novel is that kind of book. Some events in Union Atlantic read as though the author had been listening in on the private conversations that led to the economic collapse and the bank bailouts that followed. But he finished the novel well before the economic meltdown. NPR's Lynn Neary talked to him about his uncanny ability to see where the country was going before it even got there.
Adam Hazlett likes old-fashioned novels, novels that take a sweeping look into the corners of society, using carefully imagined characters to explore the relationships between the rich and poor, the powerful and powerless, the good and the bad.
The idea of the novelist in the world trying to tackle the complexity of contemporary life is something that I take seriously.
Back in the late 90s, Hazlett was reading about the Federal Reserve and some of the economic problems that were beginning to stir back then.
It struck me that there were these people who had enormous amounts of power over the economy, the whole economy, and yet we really didn't understand what they did. They weren't elected. People didn't have any opportunity to make anyone answer for anything. And, of course, it's easy maybe just to make a political judgment about that. But as a novelist, what I wanted to do was take the reader into those people's minds to find out for myself and then also maybe for the reader what drove people in those positions.
And so Hazlett came up with the story of Union Atlantic, a bank on the verge of failing due to a high-risk and highly irregular gamble by one of its most arrogant and ambitious young lions, Doug Fanning. Stepping in to save the situation is Henry Graves, president of the New York Federal Reserve. In this excerpt, read by Hazlett, Graves is meeting with the bank's president to discuss their options.
Let me start by saying that if you and your board is under the impression that Union Atlantic is too big to fail, you're mistaken. There's no question here of a bailout. If you go under, the markets will take a substantial hit, but with enough liquidity in the system, we can cut you loose. I hope you understand that. This, of course, was a bluff. Henry had already begun receiving calls from the Treasury Department. The secretary was confident, his deputy said, in their transparent euphemism, that the Federal Reserve shared his concerns about market stability. Translation, the White House is watching this one.
Hazlett wrote those words before most of us had any idea our major financial institutions could be so vulnerable. Hazlett sounds as surprised as anyone that his fiction dovetailed so neatly with reality.
I mean, it was an uncanny experience. The week that I finished the manuscript and sent it off was the week that Lehman Brothers collapsed. And so I walked in and read the headlines and started reading about these meetings of the Fed in New York with the bankers. And I thought to myself, oh, yeah, no, I wrote that scene a year ago. I felt both scooped and validated at the same time and a little disoriented.
When you say you felt scooped, did you worry that people were going to think, well, he didn't make this up? I mean, he just ripped it from the headline.
Yeah, of course I worried about that a bit. The thing that I worried about more was that because of this, the book would be seen as solely about the financial world. And in a way, I think it's about some broader cultural things about the moral climate in the country. And finance was the industry that I picked as a backdrop.
To explore those larger cultural themes, Hazlett has created the character of Charlotte Graves, a retired history teacher and the sister of Fed Chief Henry Graves. Charlotte still lives in their family home, which is now falling apart around her. She's forced to defend not only her real estate, but her most cherished beliefs and values when the errant banker Doug Fanning buys the property next door, tears down the woods that have stood for centuries, and builds a huge McMansion. As Fanning's banking career starts imploding, Charlotte wages a legal battle against him and his house. In this excerpt, again read by Hazlitt, Charlotte lashes out at her brother for trying to get her to back down.
Take a step back for a moment and look at what's going on in this country. And I don't mean just the criminals at the top. They'll do their damage and stumble out eventually. I mean the last 30 years. And then tell me if you can honestly say that the intrusion of that house, the cutting down of those trees, whoever they might have belonged to once, doesn't stand for something, for a rot more pervasive. And then tell me I'm wrong to want to make a stand. You can't. Not without betraying language. And I think you're better than that. I know you are. Because that really would be the end, to accede to that, to the notion that words mean nothing anymore, that they're pure tactics. You don't believe that.
Just as Charlotte believes in the power of language, so does Hazlitt. And fiction, he says, gives us the time to contemplate where we're headed.
The world is so insanely complex and fast and distracting. And one of the things that I think a good book can do is slow the reader's attention down a little bit and give them a chance to think through some of the consequences of these changes, which otherwise are so quick that all you can do is react.
So literature is the answer.
I think it's part of it's an ameliorative. I don't think it's the answer. I don't think it's going to solve our problems. But I think that how we pay attention to the world matters. And if you can spend time inside an imaginative world, then there's a calmness and an ability to think.
Hazlitt, a writer who looks back to the novels of the 19th century for inspiration, has managed to create a spot-on portrayal of life in the 21st century with his own first novel. His incisive dissection of contemporary American culture is both funny and heartbreaking. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
You can read an excerpt from Adam Hazlitt's novel, Union Atlantic, on our website, npr.org.